You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Welcome to episode 13 of Cold War Conversations. Now, most of you will know my good friend Shane Whaley over at the highly recommended Spybury podcast, who we interviewed in episode 4. Shane and I have always been intrigued by a video posted on YouTube filmed in the 1980s by a then young US Army soldier documenting his first days in Berlin for his family back at home. Now, I never dreamed that I would find, let alone talk to that soldier, but through the magic of the internet, we got in touch, and Michael Rafferty has agreed to give his first interview in 24 years to Cold War Conversations. His story spans the last days of Checkpoint Charlie, from when the border was the heavily fortified barrier familiar to us from those spy films, to the opening of the wall and the unification of Germany. I am delighted and honoured to welcome Michael Rafferty. Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great, Ian. Thank you very much for this opportunity. What I'd like to say is a big thank you to those who have served. This is Memorial Day here in the United States. And just a thought and a prayer to those who have served and died in the service of our country here in the United States, and no doubt with our allies as well. So thank you for having me today, Ian.
Well, no, thank you, Michael, and thank you for sharing those thoughts with us, something we absolutely concur with. One of the first questions I wanted to ask you was just a little bit about your background and why you joined the U.S. Army.
You know, my father was a 20-year service member in the United States Air Force. So when I finished high school in California, I had to make a decision on what I was going to do. So I made the decision to give the Army a shot because I thought I wanted to become a policeman down the road. So I picked military police in the Army.
Right.
And doing that, I also chose to go to Europe for my first tour. And that's what I did as a young 18-year-old kid.
Okay. So were you given the option of where to take your tour, or were you just told to go there?
Well, no, I asked to go there originally. And that wasn't even my first tour of Berlin. That was a place called Wertheim, Germany, where I was with the 212th MP Company there.
Right.
And then I came back to the States. And when I came back to the States, I came to Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland. And then I had the opportunity to re-enlist, and the option came up for the Berlin Brigade. And I made a decision at that time that I wanted to go back to Germany. And I chose the Berlin Brigade. I was basically talked into it by a Sergeant First Class Mark Nevins. And he said it was a great assignment and you should go. And that's what I did. I re-enlisted and I went to Berlin.
Okay. And what did you know about Berlin before you got there?
Absolutely nothing. I didn't really even have a good idea of where the place was. Originally, I thought it was on the border of the two Germanys. I didn't realize that it was 110 miles into East Germany.
Right.
So I was quite shocked when I really got to learn more about what the location was and the story behind it, because I did not have a good understanding of it. And a lot of people don't. I talk to them now, and they have the same basic, naive idea of where Berlin is in relation to Germany as a whole.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people don't realize the, you know, the position West Berlin was in, and you know the fact that it was, as you say, 110 miles effectively in enemy territory and surrounded by the probably some of the best units of the Soviet and German armies.
Right. That's total fact.
Yeah. So when you got to Berlin, what were your first impressions?
How big the city was, how busy it was. I landed in Tegel Airport. I went to the American sector in Andrews Barracks. I just got on there. I just couldn't believe I was in a big city. And the city just, it's huge. Mm. It's a monster city. And the Tegel Airport's all the way in the French sector. So it was quite the drive to get to Andrews Barracks. And they lost my luggage. So I had to go a few days.
Who did you fly with, Michael?
Oh, it had to have been. Oh, it's been so long.
Was it Pan Am?
Yes, it was Pan Am. And a matter of fact, it was Pan Am Flight 103.
Oh,
that
wow.
I got to England. Okay. So, you know, and yeah. That was pretty spooky because a year later, I think, is when the incident happened over Lockerbie.
Yeah. Wow. So, because Berlin, you know, you when you hear that it, you know, it was surrounded and it was walled in, I think a lot of people don't realize the size of it and the fact there's lakes and countryside and, you know, there was still quite a lot of space there.
Well, a lot of space, but you could never get lost because if you got too lost, you'd run into the wall.
Yeah.
And that would definitely turn you around and get you back on it. Yeah. You would really have to make some major mistakes to get lost in Berlin at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you have to undergo any special training to serve with the Berlin Brigade? Was there any special advice that they gave you?
Well, when I re-enlisted for the Berlin Brigade, it was congratulations. You're going to Berlin. It wasn't a huge amount of checking to make sure I was okay or any additional training. Mm-hmm. They made sure that I would represent the Army well. And they sent me. There was no specific training. And when I first got there, what I did was I worked what we call the road, which was law enforcement in the American sector. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, four or five military bases, or we call them caserns or barracks, in the American sector. And I'm not sure what the British and the French called them. I don't know if they called them caserns as well. But we patrolled the housing areas where the dependents were, and that's basically what we were. But when I was all excited when I re-enlisted that I was going to go and not have to go out to the woods and play soldier. I thought I was just going to be all dressed up, look pretty, and wave people on base and do law enforcement. But the military police unit there had a huge combat support responsibility with the 4th, 5th, and 6th battalions of the 502nd Infantry.
Yeah.
So I was there for maybe a month before we went to Wildflick in Germany on a field problem. And I supported 6th of the 502nd for a month.
Mm-hmm.
So, with some really great soldiers that went with me. So
right. And were you given, I mean, because this was whilst the Red Army faction was active, were you warned to look out for terrorist activity or anything like that? Or was that just
on parcel? You always paid attention. I mean, my first tour was you know, the bombing of Bell Disco in Berlin, and the situation increased, you know, that we had to pay more attention. But you always had to have your head on a swivel. Just like the soldiers that we have, the Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, they come home with a heightened sense of awareness when they're on the road and doing things. It was the same thing, dealing with in Germany.
Okay, and what were you told about the East?
That was supposed to be their communist capital, that it was their showplace, and that we were there to make sure that we maintain the freedom of West Berlin. And, you know, we didn't want any international incidents. So we were briefed. When you first got to Berlin, you went to a school of standards, and where you were taught basic German and the expectations of what the Berlin Brigade had for you as a soldier. Mm-hmm. And what they expected of you. And I you know, sometimes I let them down. I didn't perform the way I should have. And I got smacked on the hand for it. But overall, I think I represented the Army well there. Yeah.
Because how old were you then? You were quite young, weren't you?
I was. I think I got there when I was 22 and I left when I was 25.
Okay. So how were you chosen for duty for Checkpoint Charlie?
Well, I was lucky. I was not in good graces at the time, believe it or not. An incident had happened, and they weren't too pleased with me. So I needed a redemption. And the person that gave me the redemption was a guy named Staff Sergeant Douglas Champagne. And also a Major Bronstein made the final decision that allowed me to go to the checkpoints to allow me to be in Berlin Access. And the first checkpoint I went to was Bravo. Okay. And Bravo was the either end of the Berlin corridor, which was traveling from Helmstedt to Berlin. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. No, I'm familiar with that. That's where this is the road link from Helmstedt to Berlin.
Correct. And I did that for a couple months, and then an opening happened at Checkpoint Charlie, and they asked me if I wanted to do that, and I was all about it. So they gave me an opportunity to go down to the checkpoint, and I think I got there sometime in early summer of 89, and that's when I started working.
Impeccable timing then.
Yeah, it couldn't have gotten any better, because I got a taste of the way it was while it was still stressful, was still drama. And then obviously what happened later on.
Yeah. And what was your role at Checkpoint Charlie? What did you do? I mean, you weren't stopping people there, were you? You were.
Well, the responsibility of the NCYC was to monitor American allied traffic going into East Berlin. So an American soldier comes to the checkpoint, that American soldier has to be in uniform. That uniform is his identification. He doesn't have to show a passport. Mm-hmm. Their dependents, if they're from Berlin, they get issued a United States Forces ID card. And they just show the picture page and the USFB ID card front. And that's their identification. They just put it up to a closed window, and the East Germans have to look at it and be satisfied with that. Now, if you're a American coming from the West Germany with a soldier, same thing. You roll up your windows, doors locked. They look inside, they see the American in uniform, that's his ID, mm-hmm. and they see the other civilians in there, and all they have to do is show the country of origin and the picture page of their passport, and then they just let them go through. Our job as NCYC at the checkpoint, the non-commissioned officer in charge, was to monitor these people to make sure we had accountability of them when they went over. So they could start going over as early as 8 o'clock, and they had to be back before midnight. Mm-hmm. So we'd give them a book, and on the book it had a number, and that's how we tracked them. We tracked them on a little sheet, so the time in and a time out, and who was over there. And not everybody could go over there. Let's say you are not affiliated with the military at all, and you're just an American, you would go on the other side of the East German checkpoint, and you'd pay a 10-mark visa and have a mandatory exchange of 25 marks, West marks to East marks. But if you're an American with the military, you could go get East marks over at the train station at 10-to-1 ratio, and you were like a millionaire going into the East.
Yeah.
I mean, you could buy nutcrackers, smokers, you name it, just all kinds of good stuff. And a lot of people did that, but that wasn't the role of the American presence. The American presence in the Soviet sector was to keep free and unrestricted access into East Berlin inside the Soviet sector. And that was it. The shopping was just a bonus. So,
and when you talk about the Soviet sector, I mean, basically the Allies didn't recognize East Berlin as the territory of the GDR. They still treated it as though it was the Soviet sector.
Yes, absolutely correct. Yes. And that's how we treated it. We would see Soviet officers and we would render a hand salute because in theory they were our allies. And we would, you know, render the hand salute to the officers and give the greeting of the day and motor around the Soviet sector. As long as we didn't leave the Soviet sector, we were fine. And there was a lot of things to see in East Berlin. So
all the best museums were that side. All the biggest ones.
I did not visit one museum. I went to the Karlshorst. I'll take that back. Karlshorst, where they signed the World War II surrender.
Yeah.
And also to the Soviet cemetery in Treptow. Those were my two favorites. Because I thought, did you ever go to Treptow at all?
Yeah, I've been to Treptow and Karlshorst. And Treptow is very impressive, I always find.
Yep. Unbelievable place.
And what did you have any interactions with the East German border guards?
You know, the only interactions we would have is when they would hold somebody up. When they wouldn't let them process the checkpoint, we'd start getting traffic jams. You know, we weren't armed, and the NCOICs weren't armed, so we could walk across the border and kind of look inside what was, you know, what was going on. And it was normally the State Department who would take a diplomat and they drop them off at the airport there, and then they'd come back missing a person, and that would confuse the East Germans or really, you know, give them issue, and they would hold for hours sometimes a State Department vehicle right there at the checkpoint, and then we'd have to call the interpreters, the Russian interpreters, who would demand to see a Soviet officer, and the Soviets would come down and say, let him go. And then it would be over. Sometimes they just did it to harass us. And, you know, talking about the 1960s when Alan Leitner, the diplomat that was detained for not showing his ID.
Yeah.
You know, the East Germans like to do that every once in a while. They like to just mess with us.
Yeah. Just flex their muscles and show who's sort of in charge. What, I mean, before the fall of the wall, did you have any sort of incidents aside from those blockages of the checkpoint and diplomats that you had to deal with, or was it, you know, generally pretty calm? I've seen videos of sort of like demonstrators trying to goad the border guards and things like that. Did you have any incidents like that?
The demonstrators like to come around the 13th of August, and you know, those anniversaries, Peter Fechter's shooting.
Yeah.
Those anniversaries were big for demonstrations, and the East Germans were well prepared. They would put barriers on either side so they could funnel the problems straightforward. But a lot of people made sure they stayed across the border. So, you know, the wall was 3 meters in. So if you're touching the wall, you're in East Germany, even though you're physically in the west side in theory. Mm-hmm. If you're touching that Berlin Wall, somebody could pop out of the door in the wall and snake you up if they wanted to.
Yeah.
Because you're in the east. So if you're causing damage or anything, or like John Runnings, the guy that's the famous wall walker, you know, he was detained for walking on the wall because he's not in the west.
Yeah.
But the only incident that happened to me was when I came to work at 6 o'clock, 1800 on a day. And I started working, you know, the evening. I get a phone call, and the guy goes, hey, this is Sergeant Major from this specific unit. And I go, hey, Sergeant Major, how are you doing? He goes, well, one of my soldiers sneaked over in East German in the trunk. And I'm like, oh, dear God, please say it wasn't during my time. And I'm starting to panic. Yeah. I'm like, who is this guy? So I looked at the sheet. And thank God that guy came in a minute before I took over.
Wow.
1 minute. Yeah. So nobody got in trouble. But we were supposed to check the vehicles, you know, the trunks for two things. One, for stowaways. And if we got a stowaway, you know, of course that soldier would get in trouble because that's not what his intention of going over was. And the other thing was excessive shopping. So because that's not what you're there for.
Yeah. What happened in that situation? I mean, if somebody had bought too much, what would you do?
Well, it depends. A lot of there's been soldiers that have come across intoxicated, and you process them just like a drunk driver. You know, you have a patrol come down, and the patrol processes them. Mm-hmm. And those ones that have come over and have shot too much, that we had a video camera, we parked them in the parking lot, we'd make them take everything out, and we'd video it all to include what they looked like after they came out of the East, because a lot of them decided that they didn't have to be in uniform anymore. Right. So they would take their tie off and think they were back on the civilian world, back on the block is the way we call it.
Yeah.
So we send that to the commanding general, and normally we would do a bar of travel to East Germany, and we'd bar them from the city.
Right.
So our computers, anytime they would want to come to the city, would say, you're barred, you cannot travel to Berlin.
Okay.
So we barred quite a few people for doing dumb stuff. So, I mean, people would come up the corridor, they'd come up from Alpha, and then they'd come through Checkpoint Charlie. And right. We'd look at them and go, hey, do you know your alphabet? And they'd go, yeah, we know the alphabet. I said, go ahead and say it. And they go, A, B, stop. You forgot B, brother. So we'd bar them from the city, and they'd be upset they couldn't go to East Berlin, but that's just the rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Now, talking of East Berlin, you have a fantastic video on YouTube, which is sort of like a video diary of you. Well, it's a video diary of where you lived and a visit to East Berlin, isn't it?
It sure is. I did that with my good friend Casey Beamer. We were both brand new to Berlin. That was the first time either of us had walked over. And the guy that you see there processing us is Greg Steffen. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of funny. A few months later, he was the one that actually on the job trained me on how to be an NCOIC at Checkpoint Charlie.
Right.
And I didn't know back then that you couldn't video a briefing. You know, I'm trying to get him to tell us about it. But, you know, Casey and I wanted to do something for our families, and we decided to take a big old huge VHS fed camera into the East and do our thing. And when we finished, you know, we sent it to our family. And when YouTube came along, I thought it would be something that I could share on YouTube, which I did. And not all of it, the feedback has been positive. I mean, there's some really nasty comments on there about, you know, stuck up Americans. And granted, we were pretty immature. I don't, you know, we were, but, you know, hey, that's how we were back then. Just young, immature kids.
Yeah.
You know,
no, so. I think it's a great, it captures, you know, the time and the place and the way you were then. So, you know, that, you know, people change. They're not always the.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And everything was high speed back then. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll put a link to that video in the show notes, because I'm sure people will be keen to see that. What did you like about the job? What did you like most about being on Checkpoint Charlie?
I think the best part was just meeting people, becoming friends with a lot of the British RMPs that I still have today. I messing with the tourists, that was always fun. You know, when you sit there and you tell somebody, you know, Checkpoint Charlie's named after Charlie Chaplin, you know, and they believe you and they walk away, you know, that's pretty funny.
Yeah.
It's Sergeant Stefano always had a thing where he would yell at a tourist and he would ask them where they're from. And no matter where they would say, he would always say, I'm from there too. And the guys would come up and he'd have this long-winded conversation about a place he's never been. And they were shocked that Americans were there. You know, we'd been there for, what, 20, 27, 28 years.
Well, the tourists were shocked that Americans were – well, I just find that a bit incomprehensible. But then people's grasp of history is not always as strong as
and that's
I would like it to be.
That is so true. When they ask you if you speak English – the American flag is flying right there. It flies 24 hours a day, and you're asking me if I speak English. And I would just say, no, the Brits do. And they'd walk over, and the Brits used to do the same thing to us. You know, so it was just funny, and we'd go, hey, you got me on that one. Yeah.
So did they feel like long days then sometimes? Did the days drag?
For the NCYCs, they were 12-hour days.
Right.
So we'd go from 6 to 6, and, you know, you work two 12s in the morning, in the days, two 12s in the evening, and then you'd have 4 days off. And did they seem long? Only when it was like a Sunday seemed long, because not many people went to the east because all the stores were closed.
Right.
You know, nobody went over to sightsee. You know, they went over to shop. You know, a lot of people, you know, that was just a fact. You know, they'd come all the way from West Germany through the Autobahn to be able to buy a cheap nutcracker.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yeah.
And those days when there weren't a lot of travelers, those were kind of boring. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't a lot of people walking around the checkpoint. But holidays, anniversaries like the 13th of August, the place was packed.
Yeah.
You know, it just full of people, and you got to answer questions and take photographs. You know, that was an honor when people would ask to get your photograph in front of the checkpoint. I mean, that was, you know, hey, I'm somebody important. So yeah. You know, we'd go out, we'd get the British guys and the French gendarmeries come out, and we'd all take a photo together.
So there were all three of you there. So there was British, French, and American in that checkpoint.
Correct. And the only reason why the American flag flew was it was in the American sector.
Right.
So that's the only reason why the flag flew in front of the checkpoint 24/7.
Okay. And in the East German parts, in, you know, the East German side, there weren't any permanent Soviet personnel stationed there. They were all East German, unless there was a reason to call Soviet personnel in.
Yeah, if they decided to give us a problem or if there was an issue, I mean, in the past, people have had heart attacks and passed over there, so we've had to get the Soviets involved. So we get the people back over into the West. But, you know, whenever there was a problem, the Soviets would request them. 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't show. And because they don't care. They didn't care at all about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, if you ever talk to Vitaly, who's my friend on Facebook, you'd have to ask his opinion on any of the problems that they'd have with Americans.
Yeah.
Because he would have a better view of that. But he was.
I'm keen to hear the other side's view at some point. So, yeah, I'm hoping to speak to Vitaly at some point.
He's a super guy. Yeah, I mean, I really have enjoyed my friendship with him.
So the bit that most people want to hear about, I think, in this chat with you is the fall of the wall. So when and where did you hear about the fact that the wall was open?
Well, I was watching AFN, so I was just sitting there watching TV when they said that the travel restrictions were being lifted. Now, during that time, there was a lot of movement into Hungary and Czechoslovakia, and people were going around about to get out of East Germany. And so I didn't really think anything of it. I called down to the checkpoint, Nate Brown, Staff Sergeant Brown, who is the senior NCOIC down there. Mm-hmm. I said, Nate, is there anything going on? He said, nope, it's pretty boring. And I said, okay, well, I'll be there to relieve you at 6 a.m. He said, okay, I'll see you then. Now, it was Veterans Day. So we were expecting a whole ton of veterans to come up. There was a 4-day weekend. So not just veterans, but soldiers coming up because they had a 4-day weekend. So we were expecting it to be busy anyways. And when I got there at 6 a.m, I was briefed on the way down there that it was a mess. And I got to Nate and I said, you told me nothing was going on. He just shrugged his shoulders and looked at me like I was crazy. He didn't even say anything to me. He said, it's all yours. So when he would brief Berlin-based soldiers going over the East, and I would deal with anybody that was brand new, so I'd actually be inside the checkpoint. So any picture you see of Checkpoint Charlie taken on the day of the 10th, I'm in there in my misery, processing soldiers and families that have never been to the East, And these people don't know what they're doing. So at the beginning, the first 50, 100 people, I'm doing this professional briefing saying the East German checkpoint, as you see the checkpoint, and this is how you process it. And you, when you're done, you come right back here. Here's your book. It's got a number on it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm doing a professional. By the time you get to 100, 150, 200 people, you just give them a book and you point east and you say, good luck to you, guy. Read the book. So,
and you know, I'm amazed that loads of so these were U.S. Army personnel and their dependents who wanted to go east on
absolutely. That was their only role. That was it.
But I'm surprised they'd want to go east then, you know,
on that day.
Yeah.
Well, because it was Veterans Day holiday. They had a 4-day.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, they all just came up. It was a vacation. Nobody expected the wall to fall.
Yeah.
You know, we had traffic jams on the corridor. We had people screwing up, you know, coming back through, you know, going to Alpha to Charlie. It was just a mess. The tracking of people was just horrendous.
Yeah.
And then we would get calls from the Clay compound, which is our headquarters, saying how many people are coming across. Now, if you see any pictures from that time frame, I looked across and I said, how do you expect me to count? They said, count for 10 seconds and then multiply it by 6 or whatever to get what you have per minute. And then times that by 60, you know, this math equation. and you see a sit rep. It's an official sit rep that I eventually got. And I'm looking at it going, that's a lie. That's a lie. I made that up. You know, and I'm like, oh, my God. I even tweeted the president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, you know, recently. And I said, Mr. President, I wanted to apologize for those numbers. I made them completely up. I was too busy to count. So I wanted to apologize, but it was impossible to count anything.
Wow. So it's just like this human onslaught, you know, this avalanche of humanity coming through the checkpoint.
If you've ever sat next to a Trabi, the Trabi has a distinctive smell.
Yeah.
And it would idle right next to the checkpoint door.
Lovely.
And you do that for 12 hours, you're not feeling so hot. So I was not feeling so hot after the completion of that day. It was pretty bad.
And did any of the East Germans that came over speak to you?
Oh, many.
What were they saying?
Mainly it was a drunken happiness. It was just, you know, a lot of them were just happy. You know, you get strange hugs, you know, and it wasn't like, you know, thank you for being, they didn't really know about it. You know, it was just, they were just happy to be over.
Yeah.
And they went to the, first thing they did was they got their money at the bank because each one of them got 100 Westmarks.
Yeah.
They called it a freedom money or I'm not sure, but there was long lines at the bank to get that money. And then they went and had a day and they all went back.
Yeah.
You know, their homes were in the East. They just wanted the ability to travel. They wanted the ability, like everybody else, is to get around and to do their thing. But those first 5 or 6 days were just a total nightmare for all 4 of the NCOICs. There were 4 of us. So it was pretty rough.
Yeah, yeah. So presumably you weren't, you know, advised to look out for, I don't know, Stasi agents coming over or anything like that, because presumably the East Germans had smarter ways of trying to infiltrate people than sending them through Checkpoint Charlie.
Yeah, well, they could go through a variety of checkpoints. There was nothing holding them back. Yeah. There was, you know, that was just the checkpoint where I guess sometime in the 70s they had negotiated a understanding that that would be the only one the foreigners use.
Yeah.
And we would get no restrictions on our visitations to the Soviet Union or to the East German sector or the East Berlin sector.
Yeah.
I mean, the British had the same rights. The French had the same rights. So they all did the same thing.
Yeah. Because I've seen on YouTube, again, an interesting video, which is a Stasi video of Checkpoint Charlie from the Western side.
Right.
which is quite interesting. You know, they're obviously,
I mean, they were constantly taking pictures. I mean, I don't know what they were taking pictures of. It's pretty boring.
Yeah.
You know, we had a camera pointing their direction, but it never had any tape in it. It was boring. You know, you'd be watching the same thing, just people driving through.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, they're just wasting their film.
Yeah. So, I mean, so you're there from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening. Was it as busy throughout those 12 hours? Did it ever quiet?
I'll give you the 10th as an example.
Yeah.
From the second I got there to the second I left, it was a total nightmare.
Right.
You know, there was really no celebrating for me. I was stuck in that tiny, tiny checkpoint, which is basically just a mobile home, a single wide trailer.
Yeah.
And I just was constantly processing people, and I'd get hot and I'd open the window and the trabi would sit next to me and blow the smoke in there. And so I'd get sick. I'd close it. I mean, it was just a mess. Before the wall fell, you know, it was pretty constant, but not as dramatic. And then after the wall, it slowed down a great deal. Because in March, you know, they decided not to use the checkpoint for processing anymore.
Right. So that meant you no longer had to monitor these visits and give out these folders, correct?
Correct. Basically, it was freewheeling. And they only had about 16 openings in the wall at that time. Mm-hmm. So when they stopped processing at the checkpoint, we still manned the checkpoint basically as a information center for anybody who might be lost or confused or whomever. We were there for tourists. Mm-hmm. But in the, you know, when late at night, I mean, there was nothing going on. We had a vehicle. We could drive over into the east. So one night, a buddy of mine and I decided that we were going to go to each one of the East German checkpoints and see what it was like. Mm-hmm. And I brought my scrapbook. And I had them stamp my scrapbook. So they sat. So I went to all these East German checkpoints, about 16 of them.
Yeah.
And they stamped my check. Some of them thought I was, you know, coming to inspect. They thought I was an officer. They'd salute me. Other ones would wonder why I was there, and they questioned me. And, you know, I just said, no, I'm just having fun. Just getting a stamp if I could.
Yeah.
And all of them gave me the stamp. You know, some of them were thrilled to see me. Some of them weren't. But they all relinquished the stamp, so I was pretty pleased.
Yeah. Oh, well,
I'll take a picture of it and I'll send it to you. I got my scrapbooks.
Yeah, no, I'd really like to see that. That sounds like a great souvenir.
Yeah, I have a huge scrapbook that I started a little before the wall fell, about my time at the checkpoint, the time I met Bob Hope, the time Ronald Reagan went through after the wall had fallen. He took a chip off and he drove through the checkpoint going back to the airport. John Bon Jovi. You ever heard of them?
Yeah, have I heard of John Bon Jovi?
Yeah, well, I
who's Bob Hope, though?
You don't know Bob
Hope. I'm joking.
Bob Hope was really funny because he came in the checkpoint. He asked, is this where we buy the tickets? You know, because it did look like a ticket tape area. This is where you get the tickets. So he was really nice. And I got his autograph. John Bon Jovi came in.
Yeah.
And he actually sat down with me inside the checkpoint. It was late at night. And he talked to me for maybe 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden the door flew open and a bunch of people started screaming. And a guy started taking pictures.
Yeah.
And he apologized. I asked for his autograph. He said, sure. And he signed it. And then he took off. It was pretty cool.
And did I see a photo of you on Facebook with Sylvester Stallone as well?
No, that was Sylvester Stallone was when I wasn't at the checkpoint yet.
Oh, okay.
But he tried to go across and they refused to let him go. They denied him travel. So he had to come back. But he tried to do it on the civilian side. If he'd have went on the military side with a military escort, they would have let him through. They didn't have a choice, but they didn't want Rambo to be roaming around the East.
So. Yeah, I was going to say, is that their grounds for refusing him because of the Rambo films?
Yeah, it's just, you know, bad PR. You know, that's not somebody they want roaming around in their, you know, area. Yeah. So,
were there any other celebrities that they refused entry to that you know?
Not that I can think of. I mean, the majority of them just went over, you know. The VIPs went over without any problem. They don't even process the checkpoint. They would just drive by my window. they would look at me, I'd throw them a book, and that would be it. You know, those were the four-star generals, the Secretary of Defense. You know, yeah. we didn't even blink at them funny.
Yeah, yeah. So. And did you meet Reagan?
Meet Reagan. What happened was his limousine pulled next to the checkpoint, and an aide gave me a little slip of paper, and it happened to have his autograph on it, and that was it. A 2-second drive-by, I saluted the car, and it was gone.
Wow.
So that was after he was president. He wasn't president anymore.
Oh, okay. Okay, because so I've seen that.
It wasn't in 87 when he gave the speech. It was after the wall had fallen. He went over and chipped a piece off.
Okay. Yeah, no, I remember that. Seeing that on TV, because there's that great footage of his visit to Checkpoint Charlie where he pretends to stumble over the white line.
Right. That was way before my time.
Yeah. Okay. So you have to stop monitoring the visit. So then from March to June, what do you do then? Are you just standing around being a tourist information kiosk?
Yeah, for a while until I kind of found a role. You know, I would talk to somebody. And for example, I saw a World War II veteran, and he was older. And I said, are you going to go over? And he said, no, I don't have the time, and it looks like a lot. I said, would you like to go over? And he looked at me. I said, I'll be glad to take you over. So he got in my MP vehicle, and I took him to the east. We drove around, and he was thrilled. We had a ball. And I did that for a few people, you know.
Yeah.
It was basically the tour guide service. So if I had time, I did that. You know, I found somebody that, you know, thought it was a little overwhelming at the time. And I would buzz him over and show him around. I would always take him to Treptow because I thought that was a can't miss. Got to go see it.
Yeah.
So, and of course, the other side of the Brandenburg Gate.
Yeah.
But that's what I did. And then, you know, when they finally decided to, you know, end the checkpoint time and take it away, and that's when my East Berlin patrol days stopped.
Yeah. So take me through the June 22nd, 1990, the last day at the checkpoint. Were you there that day, weren't you?
Well, I'll back you up just a touch.
Okay.
On the 12th of June, I was lucky enough to have an Associated Press photographer take a picture of me, Terry Wynn, and Dennis Gamone of the French. So it was the Allied photo with our thumbs up. Mm-hmm. We thought the thumb up thing was stupid, so we only did it for half a second, but that's the photo that they used, and that went all around the world as an Associated Press photography picture, even in my hometown. Which is pretty cool.
Hey, front page, were you in your hometown?
Yeah, it was cool.
That's good.
And so, you know, they kept saying the checkpoint's going to go away, but we don't know when. And finally they chose a date on the 22nd. So on the 21st, during the day, I was NCYC for that day. So we had tons of press there, tons of, you know, young MPs walking around being interviewed. It was kind of neat to see the young 18 and 19 year old kids, privates, being interviewed, photos taken by the tourists and by the press. And I just stayed inside the checkpoint, and, you know, relaxed and watched it all go down. But when I got off at 6 o'clock, I had to wake back up the following day to go be part of the closing ceremony.
Yeah.
And I had to be there at 5 o'clock, which means I woke up at 4, really 3:30, mm-hmm. got in my dress uniform, and went to Tempelhof, where we practiced how the whole thing was going to go down.
Right.
And we worked on it, and I was supposed to be the one to lock the door. And I blame this on Nate Brown, because Nate, you know, when the ceremony started, Nate decided he'd had enough of standing at parade rest. He came to attention and walked away. And we all had to move up one step. So another soldier had to go in to behind me. And I lost the privilege of locking the door of the checkpoint. So, but I was part of that platoon that was the honor platoon, as the General Haddock, Secretary Baker, Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, and the other allied Douglas Hurd was there.
Yeah, Douglas Hurd, the British Foreign Minister, was there.
So it was pretty neat, but the speeches were ungodly long.
Oh, yeah.
And standing there waiting, your arms went numb. It was pretty bad. And finally, when it was over, we did this little, it's on YouTube. Have you seen the ceremony on YouTube?
Yeah, I have. I haven't watched it all the way through because it did seem quite long.
Oh, it's painful. It's painful. And, they closed it, and we had no job, basically. We did East Berlin Patrol for a little while longer, but that was basically it. And then Mae Brown and I ended up going to the brigade, and we worked on Clay Compound in the Emergency Operations Center, which was below ground. When we had emergencies within the brigade, we were a notification center. Right. So that's where Nate and I ended up. I'm not sure what happened to the other two after it closed.
Yeah. But I understand you did something with the foundation stones after they lifted the hut off the ground.
Those foundation stones became quite the collector's item. And Nate Brown, myself, and Ed Baldwin made sure the East German border guards got some of those. And we kept a couple for ourselves. But, I've given them away over the years. Say, hey, this is a little piece of Checkpoint Charlie. A lot of people still have them. And they talk about them. And, they went fast. Because as soon as that checkpoint was gone, they rushed to that. And there wasn't that many.
Yeah.
So I was kind of shocked. It was like you'll see it at the end of the closing ceremony. Yeah. You see people just rushing for the foundation stones. Wow.
And what did the East German border guard say to you?
They just said thank you. We posed for some pictures. They were really nice. And we used to make up nicknames for them. Like Helga. She was mean. just crazy names. God, Helga's working day. We're gonna have issues. But they ended up being, normal and nice. They were just doing in their mind a job.
Yeah.
They thought they were on the right side of history. And it turned out that they weren't.
Yeah. Because I often wonder sort of like what they thought that, suddenly their whole world had changed overnight.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. And especially after reunification, they went from one uniform to another. And some of them didn't even get jobs because of their background.
Yeah.
The Stasi records prohibited them from getting jobs with the normal German police.
Yeah.
So, there were some nasty ones over there, just not friendly.
And when you say not friendly, just how did that manifest itself? Were they rude to you or?
Yeah, just not overly, because we would wave and, do all kinds of silliness. And they would, some of those guys would do nothing, almost flip you off. They could care less.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the funny stories, I've been trying to get an East German border guard hat for a lot of the times we were there. I was like, hey, I'll trade a white hat because nobody's ever going to get an East German border guard hat. Mm-hmm. So finally one of the guys traded it. And 3 or 4 days later, they're selling them all along the Berlin Wall everywhere. And I had to go all the way to Frankfurt to get a new white hat. So it wasn't worth it. I should have just waited.
So how do you explain the loss of the hat?
I didn't have to explain it. It was just, I just needed to get a new one.
Okay.
And I just borrowed, the other NCOIC's hats for the minimal amount of time I didn't have one.
But I think I read something about on that, the 10th of November, you struggled to get back to your base when you finished at 6 o'clock, didn't you? You had to.
Yeah, it wasn't even 6 o'clock. I had to stay about 2 hours extra. So I was pretty much there till about 8.
Right.
No patrol in their right mind would come pick me up. I wasn't feeling well. I decided to go to Kochstrasse U-Bahn, and I sat there at the U-Bahn stop, and one train went by full of people. Next train went by, tons of people.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Finally, I had to make a decision. I had to try and push my way on. Mm-hmm. And I took one step on, and it was like a miracle. Everybody just got out of my way like I was somebody important. And I'm telling everybody, thank you, you know, welcome, thank you. And the ride all the way back to the American sector, it's probably about 40 minutes, a couple train stops. And finally I got on U2, which is the one that runs from Wittenbergplatz to Krumalanke. And I got on that one. And across from me was a little girl from Potsdam and her father. And we got going. And I was trying so hard. I mean, I was sick. I thought I was going to throw up on the poor girl. And we just, you know, just started talking. And he was telling me he was from Potsdam. I asked him if it was their first time here. They said yes. And, you know, we just small talk. And before I got off, I took the Berlin pin off my shirt, off my sweater, and I put it on her scarf. And I said, welcome. And then, you know, he was emotional. I was not feeling well. I just had to get off. She smiled, and I was gone. And wow. I just wanted to do something small for her because she, you know, it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, no, that's a great story. I've got an interview lined up in a few weeks with somebody who was 12 years old when the war came down, and I'm really interested to sort of try and hear what sort of thoughts go through, you know, people's heads, you know, when this, you know, incredible thing happened and their world changed. But that's a really touching story. Thank you very much for sharing that.
Oh, no problem.
So when did you leave Berlin?
I left Berlin in January of 91, and the Army asked me to do a tour as a United States Army recruiter. And did I jump for joy? No, not really. I wasn't thrilled, but I did it. And I ended up in Meadville, Pennsylvania. And in Meadville, I made the decision to try and get a piece of the Berlin Wall for the community there. Mm-hmm. So I brought a 287-pound piece of the Berlin Wall to Meadville, Pennsylvania, and it still sits in the courthouse today. And I did that in 1992. So wow. They were quite happy.
Yeah.
And it was pretty cool. It was on the front page of the Meadville Tribune, the newspaper. It said East meets West in Meadville. And I was pretty touched. So I was recruiting at the time, so that was just more exposure for me and the Army. And what was initially supposed to be a 3-year tour in recruited ended up being a 14-year tour in recruiting. And I stayed the entire time that I had left in the Army.
Yeah.
As a United States Army recruiter. And that's wow. What I did.
And do you still stay in touch with your colleagues?
I stay in touch. And it's strange because, like, Sergeant Champagne, I'm friends with him on Facebook. If it wasn't for Facebook, I wouldn't have stayed in touch with a lot of people. But a lot of people come out of the woodworks, and they're there, and I go, wow. You know, like Doug Champagne, I go, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity for becoming an NCOIC of Checkpoint Charlie. You put me in that position. And I got to do that because of Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and I made friends with Major General Haddock, Raymond Haddock, who was the last United States commander of Berlin. And I got to say thank you to him. And him and I ended up we're pretty decent friends just because of Facebook and you know, just how easygoing he is.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty lucky, you know, my RMP buddies, you know, that you see on your wall, you know, a lot of the German workers that work for the Americans in the American sector, they're, you know, part of your webpage now and
yeah.
They're participating. I think all that is pretty cool. I mean, they're pretty busy. You know, they get on there, they're posting.
Yeah, no, so, I appreciate you inviting them all on, and yeah, no, been really enjoying their posts. I mean, how did you end up meeting Vitaly, the Soviet?
That's a great question. I asked him back on 21 June of 1990, the day the checkpoint closed. He got out of his car, his Russian car, with his other Soviet compatriots, and because he wanted a picture with all of us in front of the checkpoint. And he even signed my scrapbook. So he took this picture, and I sent you a copy,
yeah.
And it was pretty grainy, and I took a picture at the same time, which mine is a lot better. And I found him on Facebook. No, he found me on Facebook because I posted a picture of myself and two other Soviet officers. And he said, he got online and said, I know those guys. And I said, your name sounds really familiar. And I flicked through my book and I found the name. And I said, we've already done this. So we've interacted ever since. He's now an American citizen. And when I need something translated, that's written in Cyrillic or something like that, he is more than happy to do it.
Yeah.
He's an excellent guy. I treasure him as a friend. And I hope he does an interview with you because, you know, he would be a good resource for how the Soviet forces in Germany were at that time.
Yeah. No, I really would like to chat with him. So if you can put in a good word for me.
Oh, I will.
Very much appreciated.
He's a busy guy, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Whenever he's ready, you know, there's no rush, but would love to speak with him. Is there anything you think we've not covered, or any little extra anecdotes you think you could share with us?
Did you ever hear the story of Helmut? Helmut was an elderly man that used to always come down to the checkpoint, and I think he had had a stroke. So he would constantly come down, and you couldn't understand a word he'd say, nothing. But he'd come, and he'd smile, and he'd shake your hand, and thank you, and then he'd you know, say yuck to the East Germans. And we basically took him on as a mascot, and every pin that we had, he'd wear on his jacket. And it became almost his uniform because he changed jackets, but he'd always put his pins on whatever he was wearing.
Right.
And he would come down constantly to the checkpoint. And there were stories that he had family over in the East, but like I said, you know, he never, you know, could speak to us.
Yeah.
Because of the stroke. But you know, I'm sure he's gone now, but he was a big part of the checkpoint during that time.
Yeah. Were there any other regulars that, you know, you got used to? Because you were right next to the Cafe Adler, weren't you, there?
Yeah, but we never really did anything with the Cafe Adler. Right above the cafe was a VIP suite that we owned.
Right.
To where you could go up there. And I, on the 11th, I think, I went up there, and from the balcony, I took photos. And I was yelling down onto the crowd to have them look up and smile. You know, I'm 24 years old, and I'm thinking I'm funny taking pictures, yelling at these people to look up and smile. And thousands of people look up, smile, wave. They were just having a good old time. Have I ever shown you those?
I think there's one photo of you in the crowd, but I'm not sure I've seen the photos from that balcony.
Yeah, I'll have to send them to you. The one that when I was in the crowd, it was taken by Lieutenant Kiernan's husband, I believe. And she was nice enough to give me a copy. And it's funny because it's a Where's Waldo picture. I'm in there. And I know where I'm going because I was a frequent flyer to the bathroom down there. And that's the direction of the bathroom. So I was just trying to do nothing important, just trying to go to the bathroom. So.
Oh, I don't know. If you're doing those 12-hour days, I would imagine that's very important.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was a great time, a great experience to be there and to be able to witness history along with the soldiers of the 287th, the 240, I think 247th RMPs. I think that's their call sign. Of course, the gendarmeries that were there too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, thank you very much for sharing that. Now, I normally have a few what I call quick fire questions. Just interested to know other things like what's your favorite Cold War film?
Oh, it would have to be the newest one with Tom Hanks.
Oh, Bridge of Spies.
With Rudolph Ivanovich Abel and Francis Gary Powers. And I was lucky enough to talk on the phone with Francis Gary Powers Jr.
Yeah.
So that, you know, he was asking for donations of mine, like a uniform, a hat, a brassard, whatever, for the Cold War Museum that they have. And I sent them some stuff for that. And I also sent my brassard to the Mauer Museum in Berlin to Mrs. Hildebrand. I wanted something of me there.
Yeah.
So I sent the brassard. I asked my kids if it was okay, and they thought it was a great idea, and I sent it up.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, because Francis Gary Powers Jr. is a member of our Cold War Conversations Facebook group.
Really good guy. Him and John Welsh, I believe, is his name, are the two that lead the charge for the Cold War Museum.
Yeah. I have messaged him to see whether he'd be up for a Cold War conversation with me, but I've yet to have a reply. So, Gary, if you're listening, give me a message.
He's really a good guy. Really a good guy.
Great. And what piece of music would you choose as your soundtrack to your time in Berlin? Is it Bon Jovi?
No, it would have to be the Scorpions.
Oh, yeah.
Change.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just part of it. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I'm gonna. It's the Hasselhoff song, you know, because, you know, I can't even remember the Freedom song that he sings. Whenever I think of the Berlin Wall, I think of that song. Not that it's silly or anything. You know, they say Germans love David Hasselhoff, but, you know, that song, if you listen to it more than once, it kind of gets under your skin and it becomes part of you.
Yeah.
So yeah, those two songs, but mainly the Scorpions and Winds of Change, you know, because a lot of change was going on during that time and fast.
Yeah.
I mean, it went from 8 November, everything was locked down, to, you know, 3 October, everybody's together and they're one country. And it happened in less than a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was an amazing time period and I got to witness it. Mm. So.
No, absolutely. It was incredible how things changed all across Europe, not just in Germany.
Right.
So you've mentioned that you've got various souvenirs that you've, you know, collected. What would you say is your most prized item from your time in Berlin?
There's no doubt it's my scrapbook. My scrapbook has it has tons of photos and newspaper clippings and autographs. And, you know, I would just have everybody sign it. It was almost like a big yearbook from the year that was, which was 9 November to 3 October. And everything's included in it. From little knickknacks from the German police, the East German police, the French, the British. It's a irreplaceable artifact. There's only one of them.
Yeah.
So I will take a small video of it so you can see it. But it's about 6 inches thick.
Wow.
Just jammed of stuff.
Yeah.
So, and everybody would say when they would sign it, "Oh, I wish I would have thought of that." And I would say, "I'm glad you didn't. I'm the only one." So, but, you know, made a lot of Stars and Stripes newspaper stuff and.
Yeah.
Pictures that I took, you know, there's a few pictures that I autographed for people, but, you know, I still work for the Army as a contractor.
Right.
And every once in a while, I find a soldier that I think is deserving of not an autograph from me, but maybe a piece of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And they'll ask for an autograph, and then I'll give them a picture of me in front of Checkpoint Charlie signed, and I'll send that off with them. So.
Wow.
So there's a few of my favorite guys have pictures of me. So that's pretty cool.
Well, that scrapbook sounds like an amazing document of that period in history.
Yeah, I think you'd get a kick out of it, Ian.
Yeah.
I think you really would.
If you could invite three people from the Cold War period to have a few beers with, who would you choose? And they don't have to be sort of people who were living in the 1980s.
Wow. Well, of course, you'd have to have Willy Brandt.
right? I've not had anybody ask for him yet. That's a good one.
Yeah. A guy named Frank Howley. Do you know who Frank Howley is?
No.
He was one of the generals that was involved in the very beginning, in the 40s, right after when Berlin became occupied.
Yeah.
And if you Google his name, he talks in great detail about the challenges of a occupied city.
Yeah.
And how they had to deal with the Soviets. And he dealt with them with a heavy hand. And he was pretty impressive. He went from colonel to brigadier general there in Berlin. But if you ever want, there's some good books that Frank Howley has written.
Yeah.
But he was a mainstay in the Berlin command. He was one of the first. He basically set the standards that all commandants followed down the road.
Yeah. Well, what would you want to ask him, do you think?
I would want to ask him, and I'd really just like to listen to him, and I'd like to know what his opinion of how it turned out. Because in his mind, I really think in his mind, he thought that it would take a war to end the situation.
Mm.
And it didn't. It ended peacefully.
Yeah.
And I would like to hear his thoughts of it.
And what would you want to ask Willy Brandt?
Well, he was, you know, mayor of Berlin, chancellor of Germany. Yeah. He was the go-to guy. And I just want to know, because he was at the closing ceremony of the checkpoint. And he was elderly, so he got to see it all. He got to be friends with John F. Kennedy, you know. So he would know all the secrets on how the Americans really felt about Berlin, how he really felt about Americans. You know, you'd like to think that people love Americans, but especially now there's a feeling of people not really caring for us. And that kind of makes me nervous, you know, because a lot of, you know, today especially, you know, World War II, we lost a lot of Americans during that time frame.
And he's, you know, an interesting character, because obviously he had that Stasi spy who was his aide as well.
Right, right.
I don't know
a lot about that, but that's pretty good.
And that was really his downfall in politics as a result of that. You can have a third person as well.
It would be John F. Kennedy.
Right.
Because Kennedy had to make a decision on how far, you know, and I go between Kennedy and Lucius Clay, because both of them, you know, Clay was really heavy-handed when it came to pulling the tanks up at the checkpoint and making a decision on how far we were going to go. Were we going to knock down the wall? What are we going to do to maintain these access rights? And my understanding is Kennedy said, we are not going to start World War III over this.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you're going to have to give me four. I think Lucius Clay and Kennedy need to be on there too.
So. Yeah, no, that's a great list. There's at least three people there we've not had asked for before, so I'm very pleased with that list you got there.
Good, thank you.
And if somebody's looking for a book in English that is a good history or gives good detail about Checkpoint Charlie, is there such a thing?
There, you know, the book that I'm in, and I told you, I think I might have said, this is the first interview I've done in about 24 years. The last one I did was a British author by the name of Christopher Hilton.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He wrote a book on called People's Story. And even though he spelled my last name wrong, I don't hold any ill will, because he did put me in the book, and I was honored. But he called me from England, and we talked for a good hour and a half. But the People's Story is an excellent book. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'd refer people to an older book, one done by Frank Howley called Berlin Command, because it explains how everything basically started, how the separation, the difficulty of the separation, you know, people were getting raped, killed, you know, the Germans were having a heck of a time, they were rebuilding a devastated city.
Mm.
They, you know, Frank Howley had to help with the infrastructure, and the Brits and the French. You don't mind if I say Brits, do you?
Oh, not at all.
Oh, okay.
We're all allies together here, Michael.
Okay, okay. Well, they used to call me the spam, so So I just wanted to make sure I wasn't saying anything that was out of line.
Oh, no, no, no.
But we they all had to provide infrastructure, you know, through the Marshall Plan. But Marshall Plan, you know, was in Western Germany, and we had to figure out a way to get it 110 miles into the Soviet sector to make sure the people of Berlin were okay. And the Berlin Command talks about the difficulty in doing that and how difficult the Soviets were during that time frame because they didn't want us there. And Frank Cowley explains first person about that drama, about those problems. And Lucius Clay talks about it too in his book. So when you talk about the Cold War, you know, I wouldn't say talk about the 80s. I would talk about the early, the beginnings, you know, not even the part where Pat wanted to keep on fighting. You know, these people were diplomats. Fantastic diplomats that kept us out of a third world war, or really a continuation of the second, and did wonderful things for the German people. And I just hope that we can get back to that place where we are one again as friends, because there was a lot of hope at the end of the 80s that we were all going to be happy and there would be no problems anymore. And it doesn't seem like it's going in that direction, and that makes me sad.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. I think there was a lot of hope that, you know, Russia would become a proper democracy and, you know, we'd all be a great family of nations. It certainly doesn't look like that at the moment. Is there a film or a TV series which you think is a good representation of life in Berlin in the 1980s? I know you mentioned Bridge of Spies, which is 60s, but are there any films that you or TV series that you think are?
You know, there was a show in the 80s called Gotcha. It was a funny, silly thing, but it had a lot of Berlin. It even has Checkpoint Charlie in it.
Right.
Anthony Edwards starred in that. It's called Gotcha. But it's, right. You know, it's an 80s movie. Any of those 80s movies, as you look back on them, are just kind of silly. You know, they have a weird, you know, you say, hey, that movie came from the 80s. You could tell it a mile away.
Yeah.
But if you even want to go back farther, there's a movie, Ferrer, talking about the duty train going through the East, and an East German stowaway goes on it. Right. I'll have to find that for you, but it's an excellent movie, and I think it's on YouTube. It really is a spooky movie, because they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with this guy. Are they going to report him? Are they going to give him to the East Germans? Are they going to, you know, hide him out?
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know what to do.
Oh, I've not seen that. Now, Michael, I've taken enough of your time today. I really do appreciate your time talking to me, particularly this being your first interview in 24 years.
I hope our friendship lasts longer than this. I hope you stay in contact with me on Facebook. And if there's anything I can do to help to tell the story of the Cold War and the soldiers of the 287th, there's many of us that all have a variety of different stories of their experiences. You know, I'll be more than happy to hook you up with them. But thank you for giving me the opportunities to talk a little bit about it.
Well, no, absolutely, Michael. And if any of your friends, colleagues want to talk to me and tell me their story, I'd be, you know, delighted to do that with them. One thing I did want to say was to thank you for your service, and particularly on Memorial Day. And to thank all your friends who have served or are serving, who have joined the Facebook group. I'm really appreciative of that. And, you know, the postings that they've already put up on there.
Well, that's wonderful, Ian. Thank you so much. And thank you for keeping the memory alive. We truly appreciate it. And on this day when we celebrate the fallen, remember the fallen, I couldn't think of a better day to talk to you.
Well, no, thank you, Michael. And that is my mission, is to preserve the memory and record these stories. So really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Ian. Look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that's all we had time for. But I was genuinely honored to speak to Michael, who had been an eyewitness to such a pivotal piece of history. There's extra information in the show notes, but if you want to see Michael's photos and precious scrapbook, then head over to our Facebook page where Michael is a member. There's a link in the show notes. The show notes can be found at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 13. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod. If you like what you're hearing, please leave reviews on iTunes or with your podcast provider and share with your friends. Thank you very much for listening. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.